Good afternoon. Welcome to the final part of QFT 3. So in the last part of this course, we're going to change gears significantly from what you were studying in the first parts of the course. So we're not going to talk about CFT anymore. Instead, we're going to talk about two different topics. So the first topic we're going to discuss is instantons. And instantons are non-trivial saddle points of the Euclidean functional integral. And so by studying instantons, we can learn about some non-perturbative effects in quantum field theory. So by non-perturbative effect, I mean an effect that's invisible if we do the perturbation theory that we've studied throughout the year in QFT 1 and 2 in particular. So effects that go to zero faster than a polynomial in our perturbation parameter. So that's going to be the focus of the approximately next three lectures. And then in the final three lectures, we'll discuss anomalies, which are quantum effects that spoil classical symmetries. And so approximately 3 + 3 lectures on each topic. So you've heard a little bit about one example of an anomaly from JAMA earlier in this course. And for those of you who took the standard model, you saw a Feynman derivation of some aspects of anomalies. In this course, we'll mostly focus on path and functional integral derivations of anomalies. So it should be a complementary perspective to what you've already seen if you have taken the standard model course. So at a very broad level, that's where we're going over the next six lectures. And before I give you a more detailed outline of the first part of the course on instantons, I just want to spend a bit of time motivating why we're interested in these instantons, these non-trivial saddle points of the Euclidean functional integral, and what they can tell us. So in QFT 1 and 2, we were interested in computing a number of different objects of interest, such as say matrix elements or correlation functions. And let's just denote some exact quantity of interest that we might want to compute by some f of g. So this is an exact quantity of interest. And the techniques we've used so far to calculate, in general, we can't calculate a matrix element or correlation function exactly, so we resort to perturbation theory in some small parameter here, which I'm denoting g, but this could be something general. Small parameter, so for example, a coupling constant. Or h bar. So we've seen examples both in the canonical formalism and the path or functional integral formalism where we could compute something like this by doing some sort of small parameter expansion. And generally what we would get is an asymptotic series. It looks something like this. And it was an asymptotic series because in some step in our perturbation procedure, we had to swap a sum and integral. And so what we get here is generally an asymptotic series. It's usually divergent. So we can't, it's not a convergent series, so this perturbation theory result does not give us all of the information about the exact quantity of interest. And in particular, contributions like e to the minus a over g, where a is just some constant, are invisible. So using the techniques we saw in QFT1 and 2, we completely miss any effect that depends on our coupling, our h bar, in a way like this. So we're missing something if we just use the techniques of QFT1 and 2 to compute something we're interested in. And so these effects are invisible. You can think of it in several ways. So one way you could think about it is that all terms in the Taylor series are zero. Or e to the minus a over g is much less than g to the n as g goes to zero. So it's our equivalent. So there's no hope of finding an effect like this using the usual methods of perturbation theory. Okay. And these effects that go like e to the minus 1 over g, are sometimes important. So you've seen several examples in quantum mechanics. I'll just briefly remind you of some results you've probably seen in quantum mechanics where exponentially small effects are important. So one example is tunneling through a barrier in ordinary quantum mechanics. So suppose you've got some potential. It has a barrier. And you send in a particle with some definite energy. There's going to be some probability that it's reflected and some probability that it tunnels through. And the transmission coefficient goes something like e to the minus 2 over h bar integral of 2m b minus e dx. So this is one example. So if we treat h bar as a expansion parameter, then this tunneling is completely invisible. If we try to find the transmission coefficient as a series expansion in h bar. Another example is energy splitting in a double well potential, a symmetric double well potential. So I'm imagining a potential that looks something like this, again, in ordinary one-dimensional quantum mechanics. It's got some potential that has a symmetry, v of x goes to v of minus x, and it has two classically degenerate ground states. So quantum mechanically, there'll be some splitting between the two lowest lying energy levels. Basically, symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of wave functions that are localized near each of the minima will have slightly different energies. And the energy splitting of the two lowest energy levels is again exponentially small. So it goes something like very similar formula to before. So two comments. So one, I'm just writing proportional to. Throughout today and tomorrow's lecture, I'm not going to be very careful with overall normalizations for two reasons. One is that they're not always that important. And the reason is, so these are dimensionful quantities. So I've written something dimensionless over here. Often, but not always, and sometimes it is important to be careful about this, but in many cases of interest, the quantity in the exponent can be fairly large. So these quantities in exponents usually go like some power of features of the potential. So if I make the potential higher, it might go at some positive power of the height or width of the potential, these exponents. So it's not too hard to make these exponents fairly large. And if we just look at the ratio of the largest and smallest scales in the universe, the ratio of the Hubble length to the Planck length, the log of that is only about 140. So if the exponent's sufficiently large, we don't really care what units we put in front. It's a few hundred, a thousand, doesn't really matter. So that's sometimes a case we come across. And secondly, it would be a lot of extra work to compute these normalizations. It can be done. I can give you references, but I'll focus on more interesting aspects of the story. So I will frequently just put in an overall normalization or leave out, or just write it as a proportionality throughout these lectures. Okay, so these are probably, if not computed both of these, at least one of these in quantum mechanics course. So these are exponentially small effects. And you probably computed them without any reference to instantons, at least the first time you computed one of these things. So the common way to treat tunneling through a barrier is using the WKB approximation. And basically, what you do if you wanted to define this transmission coefficient is you'd find the wave function in different regions, say the classically allowed, classically forbidden regions, and match them together. I won't go through that story. You could do something similar here. You can find the wave functions explicitly to show that the energy splitting takes this form. It's exponentially small. And so in principle, you could imagine doing the same thing in quantum field theory. But that's really hard, if not impossible, because, well, in quantum mechanics, what we need to find is a wave function that just depends on some position. So that's, in general, we would have to solve some differential equation, which even if we can't do it exactly, we can probably do it approximately. In QFT, this becomes a much harder problem. If we wanted to use the same approaches that we did, that you probably saw before, to compute exponentially small quantities like this, what you would want to find would be a wave functional. So this is a functional that depends on, well, you can think of it like infinite dimensional quantum mechanics. So it depends on the value of the, if you're dealing with a scalar field theory, the value of the scalar field at every point in space-time. So this is a really hard problem. Occasionally it can be done. You can use the same techniques as before, but it's most of the time practically impossible. And even when it is possible, it's more difficult than the instanton method I'm about to describe to you, which is harder for the quantum mechanics case, but much easier in the quantum field theory case. Okay, so finding the wave function is, as I've argued, not a good way to look for exponentially small effects in quantum field theory. Another way we could hope to try to calculate exponentially small effects is thinking back to what we did in math for QFT. So in the math for QFT course, we looked at how to use the saddle point approximation to approximate integrals of this form. So where we had some function like this. So here, C is some contour integral. W is our integration variable, and Z was a parameter we took to be large. This could be 1 over h bar, for example. And what we found is that you get an asymptotic series approximation to this integral. There's a sum over the relevant saddles of saddle point approximation to the integrand around each of the saddles. And the precise form of this formula won't matter too much. And so this is the kind of integral we're often interested in QFT. So QFT, this Z could be something like 1 over h bar. This F would be our action. And if we're interested in a correlation function, we'd have some polynomial in our fields out front. So another approach we could take to calculate exponentially small effects, like we can see using the saddle point approximation, we've got here an e to the z. That could be e to the 1 minus 1 over h bar in the analogy. So we could try to imagine generalizing this directly to QFT. This is hard, and we can't do this completely, but this is in the spirit of what we're going to try to do with instantons. So in a sense, what we're going to do is a restricted set of what we want to do in general. So this is an active area of research. For instance, Neil Turok has some recent work on trying to do this in general in QFT, or at least in some specific context, for Lorentzian path integrals. But what makes this hard is determining which saddles and contours are relevant over here. So if this is a one-dimensional integral, I described to you in the Math for QFT course how we can deform the contour to find the relevant saddles. That's a hard problem in QFT, and in some cases it can be done, but in many cases it's not known how to do this. So the method we're going to describe is a close relative of what we'd like to do in general, but it's somewhat more restricted. And it's the instanton method. And instanton method is, in a sense, a restricted version of this. And one thing it's good for is studying the ground state. And so that's what we're going to do. And so what we're going to start with is not just most of the quantities we'd be interested in computing in Q of t. We'd start with a Lorentzian path integral that significantly complicates the story. So what we're going to do is just focus on Euclidean path integrals, where the original contour often passes through the saddle points that we want to include. And so we won't have to worry about this question about which saddles or contours contribute to our quantity of interest, which is, in general, a difficult question. So I'll describe this in more detail in a minute, but just want to outline where we're going over the next few lectures. So for the remainder of today and part of tomorrow, we'll look at instantons in quantum mechanics. And so in particular, we'll see how we can find the ground state energy from a Euclidean functional integral. And we will use instantons to calculate energy splittings in a double well and periodic potentials. And we'll also learn how to use instantons to calculate decay rates. And then the next two lectures, we'll look at instantons in Q of t. And first, we'll look at the decay of a metastable vacuum in Q of t. So for those of you who took Ruth's course in gravitational physics, you saw her final lecture was on the decay of the false vacuum with gravity. I'll just briefly say, go into a bit more detail about what happens when we don't have gravity. There's an interesting story that we can, I think I can add some things, even for those of you who took Ruth's course. So we'll look at that in somewhat more detail. And then next week, we'll discuss the theta vacua, which are or in other words, we'll discuss the ground state of QCD, non-abelian gauge theories. So instantons will have something important to say about what the ground state of non-abelian gauge theories look like, and that will be related to our discussion of periodic potential in quantum mechanics. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So today, we'll go through the first part of this story of instantons in quantum mechanics and probably finish up later in the week. So the first first thing I want to discuss is how to compute ground state energy from a Euclidean path integral. So this will be one of the main things we can learn from instantons is what does the ground state look like? What non-perturbative effects contribute to the ground state energy? So this is not a question we can usually ask or answer using ordinary perturbation theory. And so our starting point is just going to be a path integral in ordinary one-dimensional quantum mechanics. And we'll just be looking at some transition amplitude in Euclidean time from some initial position eigenstate to some final position eigenstate. And the path integral expression for this is just the integral with boundary conditions that it starts the past at xi and ends up at xf, and we integrate over all trajectories of e to the minus 1 over h bar. It's Euclidean action of x of tau. Okay. So this is what we're going to be studying for the remainder of the lecture, this functional integral. And then we'll be studying generalizations of this in QFT later in the week and next week. And so the energy eigenstates satisfy Hn equals En. So I'm denoting by n at the nth energy eigenstate. So n equals 0 is the ground state. And it's fairly straightforward to see that from this path integral, we can read off the ground state energy. And to see that, what we can do is just insert a complete set of states into our amplitude. And what we get is this expression here. So I've just used the fact that these states n are energy eigenstates and inserted the identity in the form of the sum of over n of nn in the middle here. That gives us this expression. And we can read off the ground state energy from this expression just by taking the t goes to infinity limit. So by assumption, the ground state energy is the lowest energy eigenvalue. And so that means it will decay the most slowly as t goes to infinity. So we can read off the ground state energy just by looking at t goes to infinity limit. So that means if we can use a saddle point approximation to compute exponentially small contributions to this path integral, then we can compute exponentially small contributions to the ground state energy. So one thing So we can use instanton in the instanton method. Not only to study bounded systems that have a well-defined ground state energy, we can also use it to study unstable potentials. So I'm imagining something like this. And so clearly, a quantum mechanical system with this potential energy doesn't have a ground state. The potential is unbounded from below. But this system does have resonance states. So what a resonance state is resonance states have quantized complex energies. And a resonance state is one in which you define, or you only allow outgoing wave functions. So basically, you set up boundary conditions and study this potential, where the with boundary conditions that the incoming wave function is set to zero. So with those boundary conditions, this potential does have quantized complex energies, and the decay rate of this system. So if we imagine we put a particle at this local minimum of the potential. It's a metastable state. It'd have to tunnel to get out. So the natural question to ask is, what's the decay rate for a particle that starts here to tunnel to large x? And the decay rate can be related to the imaginary part of the smallest of the quantized complex energies for this system with a outgoing wave functions only. And well, I'm not going to do a precise derivation of this formula, but it is intuitively plausible that the imaginary part of the energy should be related to the decay rate, because if you just try to time evolve a state with a complex energy, the amplitude will the change in the amplitude will be determined by the imaginary part. So it's what you would expect. This can be derived more carefully. There's an interesting recent paper by Schwartz and all that has a nice and, as far as I'm aware, novel derivation of this relation. Okay. So this is what we can learn from an instanton. We can learn about the ground state energy, about decay rates of metastable states. And instantons are the non-trivial saddles of this functional integral. So this functional integral often has non-trivial saddles. By non-trivial saddle, I just mean a solution to the Euclidean equations of motion with non-zero action. So in other words, it's a configuration. Let's give it a name. Let's call it x bar of tau. So x bar of tau is a solution of the Euclidean equations of motion, which is a variation of the action with respect to x bar 0 And if we just assume we have a particle with the canonical kinetic term subject to some potential, then the Euclidean equations of motion are just minus d squared x bar d tau squared plus v prime x, where, so by prime, I mean derivative with respect to x. And so if we find a non-trivial saddle of this Euclidean functional integral z, we can use the machinery we developed in math for Q of t and Q of t2 to include fluctuations around that saddle. I'm not going to discuss the fluctuations in great detail, but I just want to briefly say a few words now, and I'll interject a few words throughout about how to include fluctuations. So if we wanted to include fluctuations, what we would do is we would take the Euclidean action and expand it around our saddle. The linear term would vanish because it's a saddle point. So what we get is something very much like what we saw in Q of t2. And we could go to higher order if we wanted. Or we're just writing the trajectories we're integrating over in our path integral as our instanton configuration plus a fluctuation. And this x twiddle dot x s double prime is using the same notation as in Q of t2. So this is just the integral over Euclidean time. It's the second functional derivative of the action. And
Dan, sorry, is that x of tau line correct? I don't hear that line.
This should be a twiddle.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So it's the saddle point plus some fluctuation. And so then if we include these fluctuations, so this is a now a Gaussian integral, the integral over the path x of tau is equivalent to an integral over the fluctuations x bar of tau. And so we do this change of variables. We'll be left with a Gaussian integral over the fluctuations, which just gives us a determinant to the minus 1/2. So same reason as in Q of t2, what we'll get is the determinant of the s double prime of our saddle point to the minus 1/2. E to the minus SE of X bar over H. So here N is just some normalization, which I'm mostly going to ignore. So in Q of T2, we often put this term in the exponent use the relation that the log of the determinant is the trace of the log. So this is just the familiar half of the trace log term brought down outside. So we're going to focus on computing this term, but in principle, we could compute this determinant in using methods like the ones we saw in QFT2. Okay, so let's look at a concrete example to hopefully make this, what we're trying to do, a bit more clear, unless there are any questions we've done so far. Yes?
So if we find a saddle point, can we be sure that determinant is going to be non-vanishing, or?
That's something we're going to have to. So I said I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but that's one aspect I will discuss a little bit. So we need to be careful that this is finite and non-zero. Otherwise, it's not very meaningful to talk about that. And so there will be this is something we'll come back to, and we're going to have to. There is a subtlety that we're going to have to address in order to make sure that. This is finite and faster. And just so briefly, an additional response to Alicia's question. So what we're going to see is that there will be fluctuations. We can around our instanton trajectory that. There will be one direction in this fluctuation space in which we can perturb our instanton solution that will have precisely the same direction. So there'll be some flat direction. So this operator S double prime will have a zero mode. And so that's precisely the issue you're worrying about. So we'll have to treat that one direction in our space that we're doing our path integral over separately from all the other directions. So that's what we'll come back to that. Okay. So the simplest example where we can see the use of instantons is the double well potential. So we're going to imagine quantum mechanics. We've got a one-dimensional potential that's symmetric and has two degenerate minima at zero. So this is symmetric. And we'll furthermore assume that it looks like a harmonic oscillator near the minima. So classically, they're two degenerate minera. Quantum mechanically, they'll be split. Basically have symmetric and anti-symmetric wave functions that will have slightly different energy. Those symmetric and anti-symmetric wave functions will be localized near the classical minima. And so, and one way you could compute that is by finding the wave functions explicitly. But that doesn't generalize very well to QFT. So we're going to look at a method that's more complicated for studying this problem, but will generalize much more easily to QFT. And so what we want to study, if we're interested in studying the ground state, is a Euclidean path integral. And so we saw, I covered up the formula before, but we can read off the ground state energy from the Euclidean amplitude. For a state localized at any position to go to any other position. So for simplicity, we'll choose the states. We'll look at this amplitude, the amplitude to go from minus A to A. And what we're going to try to do is to compute this amplitude using the saddle point approximation. And so in order to do that, what we need to do is solve the Euclidean equations of motion with the correct boundary conditions. So this is what we want to find. And so the first thing to do if we want to find this using the saddle point approximation is we need to find the saddle points. And so to find the saddle points, we need to find the solutions to the saddle point equation that I just wrote on the other board with boundary conditions that the trajectories start at minus A and end at A. Remember this Euclidean functional integral. I've covered it up here. Has boundary conditions that at minus T over 2, the trajectory should start at xi and it should end at xf. So saddle point should be a path with the same boundary conditions. So those are the only boundary condition, only paths that contribute to the functional integral, path integral. And so this, although the reason we wanted to solve this equation is inherently quantum, we're looking at a path integral. We're just looking at a saddle point, so we're solving an equation of motion with some boundary conditions. So this we can think of as a classical mechanics problem. And this equation of motion is the equation of motion for a particle moving in a potential minus V. So we've turned, at leading order at least, the quantum mechanical problem of finding the ground state energy to a classical mechanics problem of solving for the motion of a particle in a potential minus V. And so what we need to solve is we want to find a trajectory that starts here at minus a and ends here at a. And well, we could do that by solving the equation of motion directly. As you all know from classical mechanics, it's often easier if you're dealing with a potential to look at the conserved quantities. So we, an equivalent way of solving this equation is, well we know that there's a conserved energy associated with motion of a particle and a potential. And that conserved energy is just a half f bar d tau squared plus the inverted potential, so minus v of x. So this is conserved. And we can use this equation is often easier to solve than the equation of motion directly. This is first order in derivatives. So and because of the fact that we chose our potential to be 0 at plus or minus a, v of plus or minus a is 0. So there is a zero energy solution. And we can find the approximate form of that solution without too much effort. This is a solution. In principle, there could be other solutions with non-zero energy. So at this stage of the analysis, we would want to find those solutions as well. What we'd find later is that they'll have a larger action and will end up being a completely I'm not sure if the action will even be finite or not once you take the t to goes to infinity limit. So they won't contribute in the end.
If the velocity wasn't zero, wouldn't it just like sort of roll down the?
Here we're looking at boundary conditions. So we're demanding that x our instanton solution reaches plus or minus a at some finite time. And at the end, we're going to take the limit t goes to infinity. So we could imagine a solution that reaches a at some finite time and keeps going, reaches a at some finite time t over 2 and keeps going. So that's a solution to this equation. So if we assume e equals 0, which will, being the dominant contributions to z, unless t goes to infinity limit, our energy conservation tells us dx d tau is root 2v. And we can approximately solve this equation for large or small tau. So for large tau, large Euclidean time, then our solution should be near A. So near A, it's a it looks like the potential looks like a harmonic oscillator. So we can Taylor expand near A. And we've got here is phi of a, the linear term vanishes. We assume it looks like a harmonic oscillator. And the constant term also vanishes. By assumption, we're assuming that V of A is zero. So it just looks like this. So this is approximately A minus X bar omega. So that's a first order differential equation we can solve. And we get that our solution, X bar, looks like e to the minus omega tau. For tau large, A minus X bar, looks like that. And similarly, so this is for large tau. Similarly, X bar plus A is approximately e to the omega tau for tau large, the absolute value of tau large and tau less than zero. So when it's near for large tau of either sign, the instanton should be near one of the minima. And so that means solution should look like this, and we can sketch what the solution should look like. So here's what our instanton looks like as a function of tau. And it should look something like this. It gets exponentially close to plus or minus A. We go away from, as we go to large or small Euclidean time. And while it can cross, and somewhere in between, it should rapidly go from X equals minus A to X equals A. And the center can be anywhere. At least in the tau, at least in the t goes to infinity limit, it wouldn't matter if we shifted the whole thing in one direction or the other. It'd still be a solution to the equation's motion. And so from this sketch of what the solution looks like, we see why this is called an instanton. It's localized in Euclidean time. And the center of the instanton can be anywhere. And t goes to infinity limit. So this fact that the center can be anywhere is related back to Alicia's question about the determinant. So this we'll come back to this on Thursday. So what we need to do next, so I'm just about out of time, is we need to use this solution to compute the path integral we're interested in, the amplitude to go from minus A to A. And so we'll do that next time. What we'll need to do in order to compute that amplitude is, one, compute the Euclidean action of this solution, which is straightforward, and we could do that in two more minutes, if I had two more minutes. But The other step that we're going to have to do is we're going to have to look for other solutions of the Euclidean equation's motion. And it turns out we will find other solutions. And we'll need to account for all of the solutions in order to get, we can get a better approximation to the amplitude and hence the ground state energy that we're interested in if we include the other solutions to the set of equations in motion. So we'll find those on Thursday. They're related to this solution and the anti-instanton solution, which is just the same solution we just found. With tau going to minus tau. So this, if instead of looking at the amplitude to go from minus a to a, we looked at the amplitude to go from a to minus a, this is the first solution to the Euclidean equations of motion we would have found. So it looks just like the solution, just flipped. And what we'll find next time is that there are also solutions that look like combinations of instantons and anti-instantons. So that's what we'll do next time.